content, parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It is 11 o'clock. Welcome. It's Wednesday, April 15th. No longer tax day. We got a reprieve for a few minutes. And thank you for joining us for part two of the 86th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show for about the next hour at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that. And if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, as is quite often the case with me, it is another example of my shameless self-promotion. That's one of my That's one of my tunes called You've Got to Stop and Help Your Brother, which I thought was pretty appropriate for tonight's topic, since I think that given the current state of affairs and the areas that we're going to be discussing tonight, it always bodes well to remind our listeners that in times of trouble, it's best if we help each other rather than point fingers and try to do blaming.
Yes, definitely. As Dr. Mathis alludes, tonight's episode is entitled Flirting with Disaster, Coping Under Crisis, Part 2, with a nod to Molly Hatchet, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so tonight I thought we would delve into the world of Fred Gretsch and Gretsch guitars. And while I think I have talked about the White Falcon before, I thought we would do, a nod to Mr. Chet Atkins, who, like a lot of really greats, is no longer with us. But He was notoriously famous for playing Gretsch instruments, and there was a number of them that were made for him. And the particular model that they came out with was the Gretsch Chet Atkins Country Gentleman and the Chet Atkins Tennessean. And so what it, those were two specialty items that were just right above and just below the Chet 6120, which was his sort of first major model. The Country Gentleman was considered the higher end of the three, with the Tennessean holding down the bottom end, so to speak. And back in the day, when they were originally released, which was in the late 50s, the bottom end, the Tennessean, was $295. Man, if that were the case today, right? the 6120. The 6120 was the mid-range, which was $400, and the Country Gentleman was $525, which is still below what the White Falcon was, which was closer to six something. I don't remember. I think it was $650, which is still today. It's kind of the top of the Gretsch's food chain, but it's a whole lot more than $650. Originally, Chet played the 6120. That was his kind of go-to guitar. And the Country Gentleman were his two main studio guitars. And they came out with a quote-unquote new and improved version in 61 that was a double cutaway, because all the original guitars were a single cutaway guitar. And they were thin-lined. They're semi-hollows or hollows, but they're thin line so that they don't feed back as much. So Chet, even though Gretsch was giving him these guitars, every time they come out with a new model, they would just give him one because, you know, he'd play it and they'd have pictures of him. And it's just like a lot of the artists do today. You know, you see, you know, Zach Wild playing a guitar. You see David Gilmour or whatever. You're like, oh, got to have one of those. So, you know, that was true back in the day, too. And even though, you know, Chet certainly helped produce all the new, you know, promote the new guitars, he really stuck with his original 6120 for a really, you know, pretty much from his go-to guitar, which was launched officially, I think, in 58 at the NAMM show, which was in Chicago that year. And Chet showed up so he could personally demo it, and everybody was like oohing and aahing over it. And the reason that the Chet and the Country Gentleman were so highly sought after, in the sense that the Country Gentleman in particular had been designed to avoid feedback, because as the 50s were coming to an end and the 60s were coming in, music got a lot louder and people were going away from lower volumes live to playing at higher volumes, especially with the rock and roll stuff, but, you know, with the Chuck Berry stuff and the Bo Diddley stuff and the Richie Valens and, you know, all those guys, Buddy Holly, all that kind of stuff was you know, way high in the charts, and rock and roll was really coming into its own. This is just prior to the Beatles, even though they were playing together in Hamburg and in Europe and in England. This is the Silver Beatles. They didn't really come to America's attention until the 60s. So as music was turning up the volume, these hollow bodies were feeding back like crazy, and they still do that today. You have to kind of do, in the words of Mr. Anderson and Beavis and Butthead, you got to finesse it. So you can't just stand in front of a big Marshall with a hollow body with a loud volume, because you'll be getting this obnoxiously screeching feedback. So there's one of the major techs there, pickup techs there, was Ray Butts for Gretsch. And he said, hey, if you want to minimize feedback, instead of having this floating bridge, why don't you have a secure body top and not have a floating bridge, a more secure bridge? So for those of you who don't know what a floating bridge is, where the strings cross over the bridge on the bottom part of the guitar near the base of the guitar, a lot of your Gretsches have a movable bridge. It's called a floating bridge. You actually take it and move it, and that was one way you intonated the guitars back in the day before they had individual saddles. So what they did with the Country Gentleman was they had a bridge that was not floating, so it was mounted to the top of the guitar so that it was no way to move it, so it wouldn't vibrate and the wood wouldn't vibrate at loud volumes and increase the feedback. All right, so this kind of helped out, and it's also a thinner body guitar, so the thinner bodies that are semi-hollow body or full-line hollow bodies vibrate a whole lot less because there's less air to move in, so they don't give as much feedback. So they act a little bit more kind of like a cross between a solid body and a full-fledged, thicker hollow body, like some of the big ES guitars that Gibson makes. So that was one of their solutions. They also came out with new pickups. So again, the Ray Butts, one of their big designer guys, came out with this thing called Filtertrons, which are now kind of the standard pickups for Gretches. But originally, Gretches had Dynasonic pickups. And so that was kind of a problem because they would feedback a little easier too. So, Ray Butts to the rescue doing the Filtertron pickups, which started coming out on all their guitars, which would help eliminate hum so that even if it wasn't feeding back, you wouldn't get this coming over the amplifier as much because they had some humbucker circuitry in there. That's how the humbucker pickups got their name, by the way, because they bucked the hum from the amplifier because they're two magnets instead of one. All right. Wow. And as I mentioned a minute, yeah, that's why they call humbuckers, because they buck the hum. Yeah, they don't do other things with the hum that doesn't start with an H. Okay, or B. Anyway, so that's why a lot of your single coil pickups that are like on Telecasters or Stratocasters or the Dynasonics even, they're single coil, so there's not another magnet to counteract the field, and that's why you get hum out of them. Now, since back in the day, they've devised ways to wrap the wires across the pickup coil so that you have noiseless single coil pickups. But that's a relatively new invention of the last 30 years. They didn't have that back in the day. In fact, they didn't exist before the 80s and 90s. So in order to get rid of the hum, you had to have a humbucker, which is a two-magnet pickup. So that's how they came about. They're also louder, and they put out more volume, but they're a little less trebly than in general than the single coils. So again, it depends on what kind of tone you're looking for, because it definitely changes the tone of the guitar. But that was one solution, and then that was the first Gretsch. The single cutaway 6120 was the first Gretsch, the Chet Atkins, that was a thinner line semi-hollow or hollow-body type guitar. So for those of you who don't know, semi-hollow bodies have a piece of wood down the middle of them. So that piece of wood is where the pickups are embedded. But everywhere else inside the body of the guitar is a hollow-body. So it's kind of like an acoustic. A true hollow-body, the pickups are mounted on top of the guitar. So there's no piece of wood in the middle. Right. And that's really the only difference, except there's subtle differences, because if you have a piece of wood in the middle of the body inside underneath the wood, it takes a little of the warmth away, but it also decreases the chance for the guitar to feed back. More space, more air to flow, more chance of feedback. And the 6120 is a hollow body. So if you thin it, there's less place for the sound to bounce inside the guitar, so it feeds back less than a normally fat hollow body, like the White Falcon. So the Country Gentleman also had a slight, which was the one up from that, had a slightly wider body. In fact, it was the same width as the White Falcon, which is a 17-inch body. The 6120, I think, is a 15-inch or 15.5-inch, and so was the Tennessean. So they were both smaller body guitars. So again, smaller body, thinner, less feedback. The other thing they did was they made fake F-holes on the Country Gentleman. So if you look at hollow bodies and semi-hollow bodies, they have that little S-looking thing on them, right? You can see through it. That's called an F-hole because it looks like a stylized F on a sheet music, piece of sheet music. So that's called an F-hole, even though it looks like an S. So the 6120
I will not make
F-hole.
A five-year-old joke.
Yes, thank you. So what happens is the 6120 has a painted on fake F-hole. There's no real hole there. But you know, it makes it look like a more traditional hollow body or semi hollow. So they stuck the fake the painted on it full there. I'm like, okay, whatever. So that was to designate so people wouldn't think it was a solid body guitar. So they wanted to paint that on there because otherwise you wouldn't know, right? Because if there's no hole there, you don't know. You think, oh, it's a solid body guitar. Now, they didn't have chambered guitars, which were new things of the 80s, basically, where the guitars, they started, you know, having just certain compartments in the guitar that's chambered. So it's not really a hollow body. It's not a semi-hollow body. It's a chambered. This gets really confusing after a while. But they didn't have those back in the day. So it was either a solid body, a hollow body, or a semi. So.
Okay.
They also made an instrument that was a 6120. I think it was called a CPG, which was a stereo version of the Chet Atkins. So you had, you know, a stereo output. You could have two amps or two channels in the same amp. Right? Then the other thing that was interesting about the early days of Gretsch and the 6120 is they came out with what's now become the standard for Gretsch's, which is what's called this neoclassical thumbnail fret marker. So if you look at most guitars back in the day, they had dots as fret markers. Some of the guitars, like some of the upper-end Gibson Les Pauls and some of the specialty edition SGs, Gibson SGs, and some of the Gibson ES guitars, they had the trapezoid-looking or square-looking block inlays. So these are actually thumbnail-looking inlays that are on the side of the fretboard. So they're not in the middle of the fretboard like dots or like the bars or the trapezoids are. They're on the side, and they look like a little thumbnail sticking out. And they were called the neoclassical thumbnails. And this was the first guitar to feature the neoclassical thumbnail, which has now become the standard in just about every Gretsch guitar on the planet. So in recent years, what they did was, and I think it's still in production, which is now, so what, 60, 70 years past the original release of this guitar. They make Gretsch still makes a 6120, but they call it 6122T, which is the vintage select edition, which is the special edition made exactly like a 6120 guitar that Chet played, and it's got the little. The other thing that if you look at all the Chet Atkins guitars, if they have a whammy bar vibrato arm on them, they're not like a bar like a Bigsby is or like the Fender is. It's this curvy looking, it's called a wire, but it looks like a little piece of spaghetti, and it's got like a little hooky thingy dilly in it. I know these are technical terms, right? in it, and it's like wow. And you only see those on the Chet Atkins guitars, or a guitar that had a whammy that was patented after the Chet Atkins. So that's a special thing to the Chet guitars. But the 6122T, which is the original throwback to the 59, original 6120, has the spaghetti, the little wire arm thing. And it's got the real cool Chet Atkins vibrato arm on it. That's one way you can tell it from the traditional Gretsch's, which typically have a more standard Bigsby arm on them. And I don't know why Chet liked that. I have never heard a successful explanation of why he liked that, but that was what he had on it, which I thought looks really, really cool. And then, in fact, I recently got my hands on a master build Fender Telecaster, which they put one of those kind of whammies on it. So this looks really, really cool. I got a Telecaster with the whammy with Jazzmaster pickups in it and a Stratocaster neck on it. So it's definitely a morphed individual kind of dilly, which only like Apprentice or Master Builders would do. And it was a 2020 NAMM show piece that I managed to abscond with. So,
sweet.
And in one of my favorite colors, Pelham Blue. So, yeah, with matching headstock. But I digress. So anyway, that's my nod to Mr. Chet and his 6120, which is still being made to this day. And so is the double cutaway version. But I don't think the double cutaway has the cool whammy on it, but I could be mistaken on that one.
Gotcha. Okay. That was pretty awesome. Thank you. Okay. So, again, we will take calls from our listeners. and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening for the next hour until, well, about the next 40 minutes now, until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, now I did this for you guys last time, and I'm going to do this one more time. So here we have a little snip related to tonight's topic. Here we go. Okay, guys, tonight's topic, flirting with disaster, coping under crisis, part two. Emergencies, some are sudden, some are unexpected, some are natural disasters, some are crimes, some are illnesses or deaths. Most are a discrete event, which then ends and processing and healing can start. Sometimes the healing process lasts a long time or even the rest of our lives. Some emergencies happen to individuals, some to a community or a nation. And once in a great while, as in the rare case of our current COVID-19 pandemic, that can happen to the entire world. It is this last kind of emergency stress that we want to discuss tonight and continue discussing tonight. We have done several shows on managing anxiety, PTSD, stress, conflict, terror management theory, building resilience, and related topics. Managing a global situation such as what we have now, with not only brand new factors full of uncertainty and changing targets, but the added cruel stress of propaganda and political wars made of the situation, both from within and country against country, can be simply too damn much for people to handle, frankly. We want to talk about what makes a situation like this unique in managing our stress and coping with emergency situations to help our listeners to better cope in these dramatic, dangerous, and uncertain times. Please note that we are focusing specifically on everyday people rather than professionals, first responders, or essential personnel, at least for tonight's episode. Such persons may have additional factors or considerations specific to their situations that are less applicable to others. So on our last show, part one, we discussed an overview of coping with major disasters and emergencies, and two, how we learned coping skills and what they are. So tonight, we would like to discuss what I have framed to be a bit more info on how we learn coping skills and what they are. I had a little bit more to say. And then three, how poor or absent coping skills harm us and others. And last, navigating emergency choices amidst uncertainty and attack. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything that he would like to add.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So I will skip past the stuff we talked about last time. And at the end of section two, I have some new material that I'd like to talk to you guys about. So on our last show, we talked a bit about how we learn coping skills in our society and culture. What types of skills are they? General categories of actions that would constitute coping skills, and some focus on stress and anxiety. Before we continue into sections three and four, we'd like to cover just a bit of additional material on what are coping skills and how they are acquired to refresh our listeners' understanding as we later speak about poor coping skills in section three and navigating emergency choices in section four. So the primary source for this is the Wikipedia on coping skills. It has its own page. And these are some of the things I had to say. So coping means, you know, they're defining it. It means to invest one's own conscious effort to solve personal and interpersonal problems in order to try to master, minimize, or tolerate stress and conflict. Psychological coping mechanisms are commonly termed coping strategies or coping skills. The term coping generally refers to adaptive, parenthetically constructive, coping strategies, that is, strategies which reduce stress. In contrast, other coping strategies may be coined as maladaptive if they increase stress. And we're going to talk about those in Section 3. Maladaptive coping is therefore also described based on its outcome as non-coping. Furthermore, the term coping generally refers to reactive coping, i.e., the coping response which follows the stressor. This differs from proactive coping, in which a coping response aims to neutralize a future stressor. Subconscious or unconscious strategies, for example, defense mechanisms, are generally excluded from the area of coping. They are not deliberate choices and are not always healthy ones either. They can be things like rationalization or repression, among others. All right, types of coping strategies. Classification of these strategies into a broader architecture has not been agreed on. And this part is my own words, not from the wiki. Over the last several decades, many researchers have attempted to identify types of coping and then corral them into a short list of broad categories. From the wiki, some scholars have questioned the psychometric validity of forced categorization, as those strategies are not independent to each other. Besides, in reality, people can adopt multiple coping strategies simultaneously. Here are some of the main categories of coping skills based in part on work from researchers Folkman and Lazarus, Whiten, Billings and Moose, and others. We will review a few so you can have a rudimentary understanding of the broadness of the discipline. So, first one is appraisal-focused, otherwise called adaptive cognitive, where the person modifies the way that they think about something. The next one is problem-focused, also called adaptive behavioral, aimed at changing or eliminating the source of stress or the cause of the problem. Emotion-focused, managing the emotions the stress brings up, changing the meaning or the relevance of the stressor. Occupation-focused, it's named on the list, but I did not get an explanation as to what that was, but I'm just going to name it for you. Reactive and proactive coping. This is anticipating and reacting to a future stressor. This is known as proactive coping or future-oriented coping. Social coping. The source of coping resources, such as seeking social support from others. And humor. Comic relief and laughter can release both physical and emotional stress or tension and thus reduce stress or upset. And I'm going to check in here with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything you would like to add.
I just have a quickie thing to talk about in terms of the maladaptive coping, which, and I put that in quotes because I don't consider maladaptive coping real coping at all. It just makes things worse. Acting out being amongst one of the strategies that a lot of folks use, and that could range from anything from putting your fist through a wall to going out and engaging in various cavortative type sexual encounters, to substance use, to driving the car really fast and recklessly, to getting into verbal fights just for the heck of it, to blow off steam kind of thing, putting your fist through a wall. I don't really consider those to be quote unquote real coping tools, because all they do is end up getting you in trouble later. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we are actually in the next section going to discuss that at some length, because as you have pointed out, there are a lot of choices people can make to, quote, cope with a situation that doesn't really go by the definition of coping as a constructive reducing of stress or consequences or anything like that. So,
yep, exactly.
Let's go ahead with that and go to Section 3, which is how poor or absent coping skills harm us and others. So we've talked about what coping skills are and what their function is when used in a healthy manner. Now let's talk about some choices we make when trying to cope with emergencies and trauma that may or may not even get us through those horrible moments, but do definitely cause their own damage along the way on top of the damaging things they were intended to protect against. Here are some notes from the wiki on coping skills. Please note that it doesn't differentiate much between healthy and inappropriate coping skills or mechanisms. I think we just don't have a name for them other than not coping. So,
other than
the Wiki
dumber than dog poop?
Well, yeah, that's not actually a medical term, and I'm sure you know that.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not in the DSM, but, you know, my copy is electronic and old, and you never know.
Yeah, oh, there you go.
So the Wiki on coping says negative techniques, maladaptive coping or non-coping, whereas adaptive coping strategies improve functioning, a maladaptive coping technique, also termed non-coping, will just reduce symptoms while maintaining or strengthening the stressor. Maladaptive techniques are only effective as a short-term rather than long-term coping process. And parenthetically, I would say sometimes not even that.
Yeah, I call those short-term gains for long-term pains.
Yes, pretty much. That's about it. So examples of maladaptive behavior strategies include, but are not limited to, disassociation, sensitization, safety behaviors, anxious avoidance, rationalization, and escape, including self-medication. And now we'll talk a little bit about what each of those basically are. These coping strategies, quote-unquote, interfere with the person's ability to unlearn or break apart the paired association between the situation and the associated anxiety symptoms. These are maladaptive strategies as they serve to maintain the disorder. So the first one, disassociation, is the ability of the mind to separate and compartmentalize thoughts, memories, and emotions. This is often associated with PTSD.
Let me interject something really quickly.
Sure. Go ahead.
So dissociation is the same principle that people use when they daydream or when they self-hypnotize, but that's deliberate and not necessarily a negative coping tool. So dissociation can be used to compartmentalize, separate, block off stuff when it's not healthy. So that's exactly what you're talking about. But I just wanted to point out that, you know, some people, if they go to, let's say, to somebody to get taught self-hypnosis or mindfulness or, you know, meditational techniques, they're going to, by definition, they're going to be getting in a dissociative state. But that's a positive, that's use of a tactic for positive ends. It's not used to escape and avoid. So
right.
I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, yeah, definitely. Okay, so the second one is sensitization, is when a person seeks to learn about, rehearse, and or anticipate fearful events in a protective effort to prevent these events from occurring in the first place. Safety behaviors are demonstrated when individuals with anxiety disorders come to rely on something or someone as a means of coping with their excessive anxiety. Rationalization is the practice of attempting to use reasoning to minimize the severity of an incident or avoid approaching it in ways that could cause psychological trauma or stress. It most commonly manifests in the form of making excuses for the behavior of the person engaging in the rationalization or others involved in the situation the person is attempting to rationalize. Anxious avoidance is when a person avoids anxiety-provoking situations by all means. This is the most common method. Escape is closely related to avoidance. This technique is often demonstrated by people who experience panic attacks or have phobias. These people want to flee the situation at the first sign of anxiety. Now, how these things affect others. Now that we've established some psychological understanding of poor coping techniques, the situation is unfortunately not so easily addressed. Let's talk about some of the consequences of other people's poor choices, and then about some situations and circumstances that could make it much more difficult for some people to choose more wisely for situational or even medical reasons. It may be, quote, unfair, but it is reality and something that everyone needs to bear in mind, whether you are struggling to cope in a healthy way or enduring some consequences from someone else in your literal or social space who's struggling. Here are some behaviors that you may see or even catch yourself doing that are signs of poor coping skills in a crisis. Some people will regret their actions and try to make amends. Some, frankly, won't care. Our part in the dance is to cope with this in the way most healthy for us. So these are some of the things you might see. Decisions. Making rash, unusual, destructive, or otherwise foolish decisions that one might otherwise not have. Those on the receiving end, be open to amends if sincere. You're not obligated to if the person's just going through the motions. And do not gloat over or weaponize mistakes. I'll give you an example. There is a mayor in a town very near and dear to our Dr. Mathis, and the mayor's father passed away, and he started making some very foolish rulings regarding the COVID-19 pandemic and changing stuff around and made a giant mess. And then he was like, you know, oh, my parent died. I wasn't in my right mind, whatever. You know, people do these things. But so my point is, be aware people do these things. Don't pick on people if they do them. And if you're somebody who does them, go make it up to people and don't be a douche about it. Number
and put
two.
A lid on your id in the
yes,
future.
Definitely. Denial and ruminating. So some people simply do not deal with their losses or other damage. They obsess on what is fair or should have been, or they freeze so deeply in grief that they cannot function. No two people are alike in how much loss they can deal with or how long they will mourn about it, and there is no right answer. This is super important. The borderline for this being unhealthy is if the person is no longer functioning as an adult with personal agency on a basic level, having poor hygiene, ignoring legal, work, or monetary responsibilities, other persons or pets under their care being neglected, that sort of thing. Also, an important aspect of denial is the huge societal denial, somewhat related to a recent topic we covered called terror management theory, that we function day to day by not focusing too much on how fragile our existence really is on a resource level. We are being reminded of that right now, even in our partial quarantine. Those on the receiving end of this problem, again, this depends on your level of closeness and trust with the person in question, how much feedback or intervention they will accept from you, but at least make one or two attempts to offer. Also, be prepared to be blown off. Also, under no circumstance should you police or parent anybody else's grief. Don't
Definitely.
Tell them how long. Don't tell them it's appropriate. You know, everybody's different. Just because you don't do it doesn't mean that that size fits everybody else. So zip it. The next part, help. Not asking for help when needed. People can be horrible about this anyway, but even worse about it in an emergency. Some people are too proud or have unhealthy self-esteem issues. Some people do not recognize when they need help. Some people may not know or believe that others would be willing to help, or they've been let down in the past. So those on the receiving end, and like if you know somebody who desperately needs help but won't ask, be proactively open that you are willing to help out and how so, if appropriate. If you have a close relationship, ask the person if they need something, but do not pester or parent them. You know, sometimes you have to let people skin their knees. Also recognize when some people are in one of the at-risk categories that we're going to discuss in a little bit. There are people who are not able to make those decisions properly for no fault of their own. We're going to talk about those categories in a moment. Next category, helplessness, deliberate helplessness. And I have a note for you, Dr. Mathis. This isn't quite the same thing as what they refer to as learned helplessness, but is there a name for this behavior or pathology? Because I had trouble trying to Google one.
So what I always use when I talk to people about this, and that's a great question, by the way, what I usually talk about is a concept that Alfred Adler came up with which I really like, called Declaring Defeat. And so that's what you're talking about here. It's somebody who says, oh, I can't do it. I'm just this, you know, I was born a poor black child, to quote Steve Martin.
Yeah, professionally fall right. apart is what I tend to say. You know, they just, I can't do the thing,
right.
and they will professionally fall apart openly
yes.
and wait to be rescued. Yeah.
Right. And but it, in some people, they really believe that. They declare defeat because they either, A, don't believe they can do it, or B, they're afraid that they're going to fail at doing it. And so if they just say they're not competent, oh, gosh, I can't do that, oh, it's beyond me, you know, then that way they don't have to risk looking at their own stuff. And so Alfred Adler calls that declaring defeat because they become special, quote unquote, and by declaring defeat and get attention in a negative sort of way, which is what he called undue attention. Love that guy. And so when
yeah.
somebody does the helpless thing, I call that the declaring defeat. Yeah.
Got it. Okay, that's good, because I had hoped to be able to tie it to a pathology that we could talk about later.
There you go.
So, you know, as I was mentioning to him, there are some people who have, over time, learned to be grandiosely helpless, taking
mm-hmm.
excessive advantage of the support and goodwill of others to carry them when they are, in fact, capable of carrying and helping themselves. I've unfortunately had experiences with a couple of these. So some people I know and some are friends of friends I was trying to help until I realized the money pit I was getting into, not quite literally. So this is not referring to people. I want to be real clear with you guys. We're not talking about people who have some medical or mental health impairment or executive dysfunction issues. We're going to address that separately. That's the at-risk people we're going to talk about. This refers to people who just don't do necessary things for a variety of reasons. They don't know how. It's scary. It's overwhelming and many more. But they let their circumstances just deteriorate and wait to be rescued. It gets worse if after a few episodes of this, it always works and someone rescues them from their situation. You know, you think you're doing the right thing and trying to be your brother's keeper, but you're enabling them to not stop. So
definitely.
Asking for and accepting help is fine and healthy. We're talking about choosing not to source one's own rescue, even in part, and relying solely on being noticed and carried by sympathetic others. So those on the receiving end of this, people who do this by choice are toxic. And perhaps out of a sense of decency, you may be inclined to help a couple of times. If you're going to do this, you should attach rigid, clear boundaries to that help. Offer to only do things that lead them to getting long-term and professional help, rather than continually enabling their bad habits. And stick to those boundaries, even if they try to guilt you or fall apart harder until you cannot stand to see it. This is excruciatingly painful for people who are good-hearted and try to be in service to others, but you are not serving them by feeding this habit. You're encouraging it. So
yep.
don't. The next one is ignorance. Some people were simply never taught how to cope with crises or emergencies. You know, I grew up with parents who were triagers. And a lot of people were not. I actually didn't know that until I was well into adulthood. Some are just lacking in information. Some can be, frankly, lazy or self-centered, sometimes pathologically so. Those on the receiving end of this, if you can see an obvious need, offer to address it. During an emergency is not the time to start teaching someone a life skill, though. You're not going to teach someone resilience when they're in the middle of COVID-19. That's not the time. Just
yeah.
Do
let me
the thing
let me tell
now.
You. Let me teach you how to swim while you're drowning.
Yes, that's exactly what that is, and it doesn't work in psychology either.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then the last one is temper, tolerance, and resiliency. So many people don't even realize it, but they get very short, curt, snotty or dismissive to others when under extreme stress or in an emergency. Sometimes they wrongfully attack, accuse, and blame others for their plight. in large, ongoing, seemingly unending crises such as COVID-19, people have destroyed relationships and friendships, destroyed trust, made forced sequestration with them into hell on earth, and worse, because they are way more aggressive with their comments due to poor coping skills. Those on the receiving end of this, you have to weigh the situation case by case. Again, I hate to keep saying this, but it's true. Some of these are not one size fits all. Some people are open to feedback and some are not. You very well may have to cut someone loose if they are exceedingly unbearable. Check yourselves if friends or family become curt or distant to you or ghost you. You may be the one who doesn't realize they're getting a fresh mouth because they're stressed out. Okay, so a little while ago I talked about some at-risk people, and these are some examples of what I'm talking about. And the reason you guys need to know this is kind of, you know, the whole Paul Harvey moment. Now you know the rest of the story. These kinds of factors can make people act out in ways that might frustrate you. They're not doing it on purpose, and in many cases, they can't help themselves, or at least they're not going to be able to help themselves in the middle of a crisis, because that curtails the simple act of even going to see your doctor. You know, everybody's doing the telecommute, doctor's appointments and stuff now. You know, it makes it really hard for somebody who's in crisis to make that work for them. So here's a couple of examples of people who are medically at extreme risk for having a problem with these things. People who have mental illness or addictions. During this period of social distancing, others who are already dealing with mental illness and addiction can badly spiral, and some people can additionally develop addiction under these circumstances. People who have PTSD and related trauma pathologies. The quarantine and uncertainty can be very triggering for people. People get PTSD from situations like what we're going through, depending on what it ends up making you put up with. Here's some non-medically at extreme risk categories. Domestic violence and child abuse. Checking on a friend during this time of isolation is super important. Quote, that is actually one of the worst times for folks who are specifically suffering from domestic violence concerns. There are a lot of social media pass-arounds with websites and numbers and strategies for people to alert others that they are sequestered with an abuser. So feel free to pass those around. Try to keep them handy if this is actually a problem for you so that you can let somebody know. Financial distress. Another serious issue we're facing is financial stress. Many people are losing their jobs in the shutdown. There are millions of people that are unemployed right now in this country. And that makes them at risk for kind of not coping and flipping out because they could be on the streets very soon. Hate crimes. People living in any other kind of bullied circumstance, you know, bigoted or high crime neighborhood, for example, it's very hard to get the cops to come down for every little snotty thing your Nazi neighbor does when they're worried about catching something every time they go out. Stigmas on race, you know, the Chinese flu, sick and infirm are burdened. You know, people are going to get picked on more than usual because the law enforcement people are stretched very thin dealing with the crisis, so they can get away with it, meaning that the bad people can get away with stuff because the responders are stretched very, very thin, and they know it. Homeless and unsheltered. And unsheltered is a little different than homeless, but it's the same basic principle, you know, unstable base of operations. Their usual places of support, for example, the public library, to use the internet to contact health resources, for example, are closed under the quarantine. So a lot of people unstable in this way have one of their only means of support cut out from under them. So they don't have resources to cope with stuff. And the last part is an article from David Sabara, who's a clinical psychologist, and he directs the Laboratory for Social Connectedness and Health in the Department of Psychology at University of Arizona. This is some coping advice for outsiders on handling other people's anxiety. So part of the article that he posted poses a question. How can individuals best support partners and loved ones who may be feeling especially anxious? And this could be coming out of a lot of the things we've named already. You know, poorly coping with stuff makes people anxious. And his response is, when it comes to strong emotions, it's really the emotions themselves that get us into trouble. It's our responses to these emotions. Panic is essentially a fear response going off at the wrong time. That's his informal definition, of course. To counteract this panic, we can try to connect to the present moment and recognize that unless there is an immediate medical emergency, we can just take a couple of slow, deep breaths and let worried thoughts pass through our mind as we reengage in the task at hand, whatever you were doing, you know, working, being with kids, checking on friends, or the like, whatever you were doing. We can also think about whether our partners or loved ones are over-engaging with anxious thoughts. For example, fretting about how bad things will be, worrying about schools being closed, or obsessing over physical symptoms. You know, oh, I coughed. Oh my gosh, I must have C19. Telling this person, calm down, does not work. There are some people it works for, but not somebody like this. But interacting in a way that takes a more accepting stance to what is happening and what may happen can be beneficial. For example, if your partner says, I'm just so strung out by all this, it's making me crazy. You might say, yes, it's so stressful. Let's just take it one day at a time and keep things simple. We can only do what we can do. We're washing our hands, we're doing social distancing, and we're being as cautious as possible. Let's just see what happens from here. The bottom line is this. Don't co-ruminate. Talk about the facts and how you're responding to what is happening and what you need to do in the future. Then acknowledge that you can only do what you can do. And at this point, I'm going to pause and check in with Dr. Mathis.
I'm good, thanks.
All righty. So he's doing what he can do. All right, we got about 7 minutes left. Yes, and we've got one more section to talk about, navigating emergency choices amidst uncertainty and attack. So these are things that everyone will need to consider and address under duress. There's a little advice, some pitfalls, and other considerations while trying to make plans and choices in a crisis. So there's a little more talk about at-risk categories and some other adjustments that we might all have to consider making. So first category is medical inability to cope. Whether we are ready or not, those of us who are able to function independently are responsible collectively as a society to check on those who might not be able to do so. Many kinds of physical and mental illnesses can impair someone's executive functioning and agency. For example, and these are just a few of them, ADHD, autism, special needs, phobias and anxieties, bipolar, depression, PTSD, etc. There's also language barriers, ability barriers, being deaf or blind, for example, wheelchair or mobility issues and that sort of thing. Insulin and many other meds need fridge or constant environmental management, addiction issues, etc. Many of these conditions require a level of management suddenly curtailed or near impossible to maintain. And what about things like, for example, elder care? Children who don't understand, or willful teens and at-home young adults who choose to defy compliance. You know, like there's all those Florida young adults who did spring break anyway, and how many of them came home and were C19 positive and a few of them have died? What do you do at that point? I don't necessarily have an answer for that. These are questions we have to think about. The next category, social inability to cope. We need to understand how frail and precarious everyday life is and how few people are prepared fully for anything major and or long term to go wrong. Financial issues, sudden loss of resources, becoming someone else's caretaker, needing a caretaker, divorced parents, people on public assistance, natural disasters. Most people have little or no savings. Many have no insurance or nowhere near enough. There's a segment of society who is very pull up by the bootstraps, most of which change that tune after a brush with said precariousness. There's pragmatism and responsibility, and then there's luck and smugness. So a lot of us are just a few meals away from almost being feral people. And we get very full of ourselves about this and pretend we don't know that. This kind of crisis pulls that stuff out, especially when you have no idea when it's going to end. And then the next category is legal abuses. What should people do when they are getting screwed? Not a legal term, but still. You know, like unfortunate laws, employers, landlords, other opportunists, etc. How do you, quote, cope with the terror of that? Who has time and money for lawyers and other help, especially when in-person meetings are almost non-existent? Again, I don't necessarily have ready-made answers for you, but you guys have to think about these things. The next section is what I call related to routines and adjusting. So there's three parts here: productivity, routines, and schedule. For productivity, the source is an article, Why You Should Ignore All That Coronavirus-Inspired Productivity Pressure. And this was on Chronicle.com by Aisha S. Ahmad, and this was written on March 27th. As someone who has experience with crises around the world, what I see behind this scramble for productivity is a perilous assumption. The answer to the question everyone is asking, when will this be over? It's simple and obvious, yet terribly hard to accept. The answer is never. Global catastrophes change the world, and this pandemic is very much akin to a major war. Even if we contain the COVID-19 crisis within a few months, the legacy of this pandemic will live with us for years, perhaps decades to come. It will change the way we move, build, learn, and connect. There simply is no way that our lives will resume as if this had never happened. And so while it may feel good in the moment, it's foolish to dive into a frenzy of activity or obsess about your scholarly productivity right now. That is denial and delusion. The emotionally and spiritually sane response is to prepare to be forever changed. Routines. Establishing a sense of routine at home is an often recommended key coping skill for being able to deal with the huge upheaval of an emergency or crisis. However, some people may cling to this notion a bit too hard as a malfunction of their coping and put far too much pressure on themselves and others to stand up this grand scheme of plans, lessons, structure, projects, classes, and routines that is in real life unrealistic and stressful in and of itself to maintain for very long. They overcompensate by filling every moment they can with a planned activity, creating prep schools at the coffee table and Martha Stewart training centers and canneries in their kitchen. And schedule, related item. Sudden emergency changes make coordinating other plans with other people, significant others, family, children, etc., much harder. And the point of all of these is that these are going to be a problem. They're not going to function how you're used to. And we have got to be flexible about that and be okay with that. And it's going to be maddening and frustrating. But if you don't, you're not going to cope. And there's going to be a problem. Next part I want to talk about is social distancing and quarantine. Source again is David Sabara's paper, Social Connectedness and Health in the Department of Psychology, University of Arizona, and so on. So this question is, as more people begin practicing social distancing and or self-isolation, what are your tips for how not to go stir crazy or get lonely? And Dr. Sparra says, be careful not to resort often to self-medicating with alcohol or drugs, legal or otherwise. Consider calling your loved ones. Have a deeper conversation than a text exchange allows, and I would add, or social media. Do an activity together virtually, like a watch party, a YouTube class, lesson, exercise, etc. exercise outside as you are able. And, you know, if you're not, go out and get some sunshine or garden a little bit or something. Find time to really connect with your loved ones, and that can look like lots of things. Focus on them by asking questions and exploring how they're feeling and coping. Keep a basic routine as best as you can, including meals, scheduled tasks, and a stopping time. A basic routine, don't obsess and don't cram stuff into everything. Make something artistic and don't worry about whether it's any good. Doesn't matter. Start journaling, even if your mood is somber. Several people have gotten really into this, and you might be surprised in the years to come if you come back to this stuff, what some of these journal entries might look like or what value they'll have. Most importantly of all, no matter how maddening it is, resist the urge to cheat or feel like you can do something just this once or nobody will know. This has already been done, and it costed people their lives. No hyperbole. And the last section I want to talk about real quick is telework, everything going online or virtual. Telecommuting, adjusting and politicizing. People working from home for the first time. Employers who said it couldn't be done, now having to do it. And some now being called out on disability or other work-life balance stigmas. How do people adjust to telework culture under time pressure? Here are some other factors related to that to consider. Accountability and discipline for those unaccustomed to working from home. Biases such as technology poor, no office home environment. There are some people in living circumstances where they have no place they could put a home office or even a setup for that. Handicapped or other work-life balance, people have been told, no, they can't work from home, even though it would have helped them. But now it's being done. So there's a lot of hostility and politicization of that with employers who pushed back in the past. Also dealing with parents and child care and elder care. Now that your work is at home, sometimes that's a thing. And a lot of people don't have access to child care or elder care any longer for the moment. Tasks that require in-person stuff, non-digital items, signatures, etc. Just these are things that people need to take into account and how to cope with telecommuting. There's a lot of people who have been home and sequestered the whole time because of various mental health issues or physical issues, and they're all sitting around, and I'm to some extent one of them, going, you know, what's the big deal? We've been doing this for years. And not trying to be smug and sassy, but people need to stop and think and remember, some of your friends and neighbors have been living like this for a very long time, and you're having a giant meltdown after 5 days. So it's time for some perspective and some coping skills. And with that, I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis at this time.
Yep, I'm good right now. Thanks.
Okay. So it's just a little bit after midnight. And in summary, we hope now that our listeners now know about and understand better how to manage not only their stress, but emergency needs, self-care, household responsibilities, and other triage under an unusually widespread emergency. So this concludes our show on coping under crisis. Dr. Mathis, is there anything you want to add on this topic overall in closing?
Yeah, I just want to say to listeners, you know, just be smart about this and, you know, don't freak out about it. Use, quote unquote, a little common sense, which is becoming a lot more uncommon these days, and be kind in whatever it is you do, both to yourself and to your fellow person, because as you've all, I'm sure, seen, you know, all of us really are in this together, whether we're in high-risk categories or not. It still is impacting us as people, and we need to remember that and not try to put the blame finger and turn our nose up and whatever. We need to be helping people. This is not the time to be, you know, pulling the superiority card. So, FYI.
Yes, definitely. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and MDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and also give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion Wednesday, April 29th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow night, Travel Itch Radio on the 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Travel Itch Radio returns to California when Jenny Wedge of Travel Costa Mesa comes to our microphone. Listen as Dan Schlossberg and Keita Roberts discuss the resort town, a shopping mecca sandwiched between Los Angeles and San Diego. Home of South Coast Plaza, the Orange County Fair, and the Pacific Amphitheater, this versatile resort community is also home base for the Los Angeles Chargers Training Center, training camp, and corporate headquarters, as well as John Wayne Airport. They get a lot of stuff there. All right, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza, Roger Noriega et al., Saturday the 18th, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe while we troll the digital airwaves. Join us as we discuss the latest news in the world of sports and review the events of the past week. No fantasy sports here. We keep it real. So on and so forth. Okay, guys. And then The Walking Dead online viewing party, normally Sundays. Last Sunday, April 5th, was the temporary finale due to the fact that the current quarantine made it impossible to edit the actual finale. So episode 16, A Certain Doom, will air later in the summer of 2020, as well as the new third Walking Dead series, Worlds Beyond, and as well as season 6 of Fear, The Walking Dead, which is not going to be premiering in a few weeks either. So we will get back to you, and when that comes back on the air, we will be back on the air with it. So thank you for joining us. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us, and rock on.